Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I want to start with the 76ers because to me it's been a really weird year, a really bizarre season for the Philadelphia 76ers. How bizarre? They're the best team in the NBA at home, but they're one of the worst teams in the league on the road. They've had some nice winning streaks. They've had some really ugly losing streaks. And if that weren't enough, Joel Embiid was booed at home on Sunday, and after knocking down a deep three, he shushed the home crowd and was seen on camera mouthing, "Shut the bleep up, in response. Not on the road now, but doing so at home to his own fans. Afterwards, Joel was asked about that.
"I don't care how it looks. I'm just playing basketball, and, just getting back to myself, just being a good asshole, just playing basketball and just trying to dominate. Thank you."
My man's so great. What a beautiful quote. Just getting back to being a good a-hole. And then there was that post he put on Instagram of him shushing the crowd with the caption, quote, "You either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Hashtag the process."
Just the process.
It felt like everything was on the verge of ripping apart for the Sixers, especially with the Clippers coming to town. And sure enough, before last night's game against LA, Joel once again heard some boos during the introductions. Listen, I get that that's a different town and a tough town and that they booed Santa Claus and they booed Mike Schmidt. I understand all that. I know it's been a weird season for the Sixers, but you can't tell me it's not really weird to see Joel Embiid getting booed at home. Except the big fella does trust the process, and he took it all in stride. And then, just 30 seconds into that game, he did this.
Doesn't go. Rebound, Embiid scores, and a foul. That'll get the fans right back on his side. That's what they want to see. You see people standing up on this, even standing ovation here for an offensive rebound putback, Ian. Doesn't take long.
No, and he gets that better than anybody. You know why he trusts the process? Because he knows as part of that process, it can turn very quickly. He knows offensive rebound, bucket, and one. Waving to the crowd to bring the noise. That's the good a-hole that Philly. No, that's the good a-hole that the entire world loves. And it wasn't just Joel. Ben Simmons got in on the act as well last night with one of the most ridiculous shots you're ever going to see.
Zubac shades over. Simmons, curl. Oh, circus shot. It's Ben Simmons. Acrobatic.
That was an incredible finish against very good defense, but he loves his right hand inside. Look at this, and off the glass.
Just freestyling, and it goes in. Look, Simmons' game is not without its flaws, we know this, but people are spending way too much time still focused on what he can't do, so they're missing out on all the things, the absurd things that he can do. You know, stuff like that. Stuff like a stat line of 26 points, 12 rebounds, 10 assists, and hassling the defense, or the Clippers on defense all night long. But again, the Clippers were not going down without a fight, both metaphorically and literally. Here is the metaphorical brawl from Kawhi.
6'8", Shamet at 6'4", 17 points, 12 rebounds. Oh! Kawhi Leonard with a grown man's move. Oh, yeah. The Dr. Light.
That's a great dunk by Kawhi Leonard. And Kawhi Leonard gave his Dr. J impression, the best that he could do.
Oh, yeah. The metaphorical fight and then the literal fight. I mean, sort of. Between Marcus Morris and Joel Embiid in the fourth quarter. I'm not surprised these two got into it, knowing their history. And Joel's stated desire to be the good a-hole. The only surprise was that it took until this long. That it took until there were less than 3 minutes to go in the fourth quarter before they finally did get around to shoving each other.
Simmons trying to toss it to Embiid. He was held.
Oh, a push, and Morris pushes back.
Paul George gets in there. The officials do as well. They exchange words, and Embiid is now walking away.
I know this about Marcus Morris in these situations. I've seen it. He is not going to take a step backwards, not even half a step backwards in these situations. He's saying, come on.
They got interlocked, a shove from Embiid, a two-handed push from Morris.
The Philly fans love this.
Not surprising, but for being honest, relatively tame, given the two guys involved. But it was just what Embiid, the Sixers, and those fans needed, because you can't beat Joe playing to the crowd as he walked back to the bench. Oh, yes, you can. You can't beat that. And he did, because seconds later, Embiid did this to Morris.
Sixers. Morris to the cup.
Do not go in there! Joel Embiid!
And they love him all over again. That's how you mend fences in the city of brotherly love. You get into a shoving match, you chase that down by swatting the guy you're beefing with, and the crowd will love you all over again. But the best part about Philly's 110-103 win last night was not that it proved that they can beat anybody in the league, especially at home. It wasn't that Joel had 26 points and 9 rebounds in just 28 minutes. No, the best part about last night was Joel after the game. Because the worst part about this season was when Joel Embiid announced he was giving up trolling. Good news is, it sounds like those days are now officially over. Troel Embiid might be making a return. And he hinted at that when he was asked if he expected to be booed.
A little bit, but that's cool. Tonight, I could have shushed him again, but it was all about having fun again. Just getting back to myself. Like I said, after last game, I'm back to doing whatever I want and saying whatever I want. That's how I used to be, and, you know, I was dominating that way. This year, I made a decision to change, and I guess it hasn't worked out, so he comes with a good and bad, so if he helps us win and if he helps me help the team in a better way to win games, then I'm going to be that guy.
It's about time, man. It is about time. Hell yes. Joel is saying that, quote, I'm back to doing whatever I want and saying whatever I want. It is the best thing I've heard in a long time. See, Joel needs to be that guy. He needs to be Troel. Troel Embiid. Embrace it. Let the troll flow through you, big man. Feel the power of the troll side. Troel, that's the guy we know. That's the guy I love. I mean, polite, non-trolling Joe is okay, I guess. Not really. But Troel Embiid is the best. Troel Embiid powers the Sixers and the city of Philadelphia. He makes them a threat every single time he hits the floor. I'm talking about the old Joel, the guy who was guzzling Shirley Temples, thumbing out tweets, and dunking on opponents' heads. And yes, it helps them win games. I know all that old junk about how you can't play angry or you shouldn't use stuff like that to motivate you, but Joe should. He should be trolling the opposition and fans, anyone and everywhere. He should be doing whatever the hell he wants to whoever the hell he wants, whenever the hell he wants, because it works. That was a dominant, good a-hole showing from Joel. And you can't tell me it wasn't fueled by everything that's gone on the last few days and his relationship with the fans.
That being going on me, I went back at them. We all human beings. If I can take it, then everybody else can take it too. So we move on. We learn from it. We move on. I got to do a better job. They got to do a better job. I understand where they come from. But then again, you know, if you dish it, you gotta be able to take it back. So, but at the end of the day, like I said, in my location last night, it's all love. I love my city. I've been here for a long time now. We have a special relationship, and I'm happy to be here. I can't wait for the future, especially this year. I think we can accomplish something great.
Yeah, I know. I'm spending a lot of time on this. It's because I could listen to that guy for hours. I can't get enough. He's finally back. Joel is finally back. Hey, clones, the question of the day. What do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? I can tell you what we don't want. We don't want another bar or another sugary snack or another energy drink. No, instead we want beef. pure and simple. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. It's not shriveled. It's not dry. It's not tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. So it's tender and tasty. It's not tough. What makes it so good? I'm going to say it's the company behind it. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. And Old Trapper is packed with protein. It comes in four amazing flavors to satisfy all your cravings. It's quality smoked meat at its finest, and it goes wherever you go. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're purchasing. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Chase Elliott is my guest. Chase, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So as I mentioned, it is your fifth time entering the Daytona 500. So how different does it feel now versus your first Daytona 500? For instance, is it something you're pretty comfortable with now and it's just another race, or is that impossible because it is the Daytona 500?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I feel like at this point, I treat it that way for sure. You know, I think you have to kind of treat it that way as time goes on. But that first one, you know, I definitely remember a lot of nerves. But I feel like the past couple of years have been pretty normal, which I think is really good. And I've enjoyed kind of settling into that and take some time to get there for sure for me. But, yeah, now it just I treat it like any other Sunday and just go about my job as I always do.
Chase Elliott joining us. You know, I'm going to go back to that in a minute. I want to ask you really quickly about the clash on Sunday. That was pretty wild now. Ultimately, you finished seventh, but there were a lot of drivers with a lot of opinions and a lot of things they wanted to get off their chests after that race. What did you make of that whole thing?
Yeah, we finished seventh and crashed and didn't finish. But, yeah, you know, that race is, you know, the race is always wild. I'm not sure that it's really a surprise to anybody. I know there was some ruffled feathers and people upset or this or that, but you know, that's good. I'm glad that people run their mouths and like to complain because it gets attention and gets people talking about it. So that's a win, really, at the end of the day.
It is. Chase Elliott joining us. I agree with you. You know, it's always interesting to me that your season opener is the biggest race of the season because it is like starting with the Super Bowl. So from a driver's perspective, how do you go about balancing the pressure of the first race and the desire to win it, obviously, while at the same time acknowledging it is just one race in a long season?
Yeah, I think the way I've kind of learned, I guess, to treat this race, and maybe this isn't the right way, but where I'm at with it right now is I kind of treat it like its own event and its own thing. I kind of take these first 2 weeks, you know, the Clash and the 500, and just say, look, Daytona is Daytona. These 2 weeks are just their own animal, their own event. And then I feel like our season really gets kicked off in Vegas, and that's going to give you more of a deciding factor as to how your season is going to go anyway from there.
Chase Elliott joining us. He is the driver of the number 9 for Hendrick Motorsports. Seems like there's been a lot of talk outside the team about the new Camaro this year. How significant are the changes? How does that ride feel to you right now?
Yeah, well, again, you know, the speedway stuff is just so different than what we're going to have in intermediate tracks and short tracks. So I think that's why a lot of times it's really hard to gauge and judge where you stack up and see if you've improved any until you really get to that first intermediate track. That first mile and a half. So, you know, I'm excited about it. I know Chevrolet and Hendrick and our group has worked really hard in trying to improve and make our car better. And, you know, to the naked eye, I don't think the new Camaro looks a ton different from the one we ran last year. Some minor changes, I wouldn't call anything major, but, you know, we're just trying to stack little things on top of each other to make improvements. And, in this world, with as competitive as it is nowadays, you're not going to just hit a home run. It's singles and maybe a double here or there, and that's going to get you where you need to go. So hopefully we hit a lot of singles and got on base a lot with this, you know, with this car.
Daytona's upcoming. Chase Elliott is my guest. Now, you've won 6 times in the last 2 seasons, mm-hmm. which gives you 6 wins before you turn 24 in November, which is 3rd most ever. What does the next level look like for you this season?
I think for me, I just want to try to assert our team and get myself and our group just amongst that top. I feel like there's, I felt like the past few years there's five or six guys that I feel like can win any given weekend and have the ability to go win. And they're not just a threat at a certain racetrack here or there. They have the opportunity to go and win every week. And I think that's ultimately where I want to be. I just want to assert myself amongst that group. And, you know, if you're in that group, I think the opportunity for championships and the opportunity for a whole bunch of wins is going to be there. And ultimately, that's where I want to get to. I think if you get to that point, the sky's the limit. And it's just about, you know, having some good fortune, but being smart. But you gotta put yourself in that top five or six guys. And if you're in that every week, you're going to have a chance to do some great things.
Or you could be one of those guys and be in that group not only every week, but literally your entire career. Like Jimmy Johnson, he announced it's going to be his final season. What is NASCAR going to lose when he runs his last race?
And I think they're going to, you know, we're going to see probably the greatest to ever do this to this point leave. And, you know, that's a lot of, I know the GOAT topic gets tossed around in all different types of sports. Probably too much, but with Jimmy, I don't see how you can argue what he's done in the period of time he's done it in, with the amount of class he has shown throughout his entire career. I think it's second to none. I just don't see that being topped by anybody else right now. So, you know, one day I'd love to outdo him. For sure, but I think we're going to see the greatest to do this so far leaving, and a great guy at that. So I'm looking forward to racing this last season with him. I hope he has some great moments this year. I'm as big a fan as anybody, so I'm pulling for him.
I respect that, Chase. And as a California guy, I've always had his back. I love Jimmy. I love the way he handles himself on the track. I think he's a class act. He's an amazing driver. And again, early in his career when he got all that flack for being a California kid. So I understand that and I respect it. Now, with respect to what you just said, with him moving on after this year, the talk does shift to you being the face of Hendrick Motorsports. What's your reaction when you hear that? And does that change how you approach the job as a result of that?
Yeah, it's weird, for sure, just to know that I'll have been there the longest, I guess, after Jimmy leaves, which is really crazy to think about, but also hard to believe I'm starting year five. It's kind of nuts, too, to think about how fast these past 4 years have gone by, but I don't think it changes my focus or my approach really at all. You know, that's kind of I feel like that's an outward view that people kind of on the outside have and look at it, but I don't know that really that feel is there internally. I don't feel that at the moment, you know, by any means. And you know, I'm gonna keep doing my thing and do my job. And who knows? I mean, you could get somebody in there next year that's been around for a long time that might fit that role better or something, but I don't know. You know, we'll just wait and see, but I don't really see anything changing much for me.
Or maybe not, Chase, or maybe somebody doesn't step up. Like, because as I mentioned off the top, you won the most popular driver award again at the end of the season. We've talked about your popularity in the past and the fact that you've got a long way to go, for instance, to catch Dale Jr. and your dad, but how much does it mean to you that you won this award? Better yet, how much is that award about the award itself, and how much of that is about the experience of going to the track every week and feeling the level of love and respect that you get from the fans pretty much everywhere?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I've said this a lot, and I'm sure people are probably tired of hearing it, but you know, I'm not sure that trophy really means a fraction as much as what the interaction you have with people at the racetrack and the desire and the fire and the passion that people have to see my team want to do good. I mean, I think that to me speaks volumes, way above any trophy you could ever get, no matter how many trophies you have. I think that's massive. And I've enjoyed that side of things more than anything. I don't take that for granted. I often wonder why, but, I definitely have appreciated it. And hopefully we can, you know, do well for the folks that pull for us on Sundays.
He is entering his fifth full-time Cup Series season, already a two-time most popular driver, a six-time Cup Series winner, and the driver of the number nine car for Hendrick Motorsports. Once again, you want to tune into NASCAR's season-opening Super Bowl event. It is the 62nd Daytona 500. It's at Daytona International Speedway Sunday, 2:30 p.m. Eastern on Fox. Chase, great to have you back. Good luck this weekend. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jim. Y'all be good.
All right, so last November, one of the most amazing interview clips in the history of amazing interview clips made the rounds, but it had nothing to do with sports, yet all of you clones were talking about it. It was so incredible and so improbable that it trended worldwide on Twitter, and it did hijack my show for the better part of 10 minutes or 10 segments. I don't even need to ask if you remember that clip, because you do. How the hell could you forget Papa John, of all people, sitting down for an interview with WDRB News, threatening a day of reckoning, and saying my good friend and legend, Mark Shapiro, should be in jail, and divulging that he had slammed 40 of their pies in only 30 days. How could you forget any of that?
Stay tuned. The day of reckoning will come. The record will be straight.
The day of reckoning will come and the record will be straight. Like, that clip could have been from November of 1919, not November of 2019, and it would still be fresh on the brain, because for as bizarre as it sounded, it looks so much worse. My man was sweating garlic butter, looking like 39 of the 40 pies went directly into his face, as if he pushed entire pizza pies into a syringe and injected it directly into his face. And sounding like at 39, because number 40 somehow got lodged in his throat.
I've had over 40 pizzas in the last 30 days, and Mark Shapiro should be in jail. He has no pizza experience. He's never been in the pizza category. I would just say, stay tuned. The day of reckoning will come. The record will be straight.
What an incredible line that was. I've had 40 pizzas in the last 30 days, and Mark Shapiro should be in jail because he has no pizza experience or experience in the category? I mean, that truly was one of the weirdest 30 seconds in American history. The former CEO and founder of the third largest pizza chain in the country threatening a day of reckoning and jail time for a legend that he says should have never been in the pizza category. Yeah, we, the jury, find Mark Shapiro guilty. Guilty of never being in the pizza category. Throw the book at him. Take him away, judge. Speaking of which, I did see Mark Shapiro on the row in Miami, the week of Super Bowl. Know this about Mark Shapiro. Now, put aside for a minute that Mark Shapiro has done more for my TV career than anybody, period. Put that aside for a minute. And there's been a lot of people that have done a lot of things for my TV career, but I could argue that nobody's done more for it than Mark Shapiro. Mark Shapiro is one of the most dynamic, charismatic, brilliant leaders I've been around. This guy's a genius, straight up. One of the most talented guys ever. And he comes on the set in Miami to give me a little bit of love. Giant smile on his face, like always. Jimmy, what's going on? I'm like, oh my God, Mark, dude, I am so glad you're not in jail. I am so glad you're not in jail. This guy's laughing so hard and saying, do you believe that? Do you believe that? And all I could say is, bring it in, brother. Bring it in. Hug it out, man. I am so glad you're not in jail, Shap. I am so glad. But not as glad as I am that PJ is trending yet again. And the reason the Papa is trending yet again is because he sat down yet again and did an interview yet again. And even though it sounded like somebody fished that pie out of his gullet and cleared up his voice, the stuff that he was saying this week made about as much sense as the stuff that he was running back out there last November. All the sound comes courtesy of the H3 podcast, which dropped a two-hour conversation with PJ only 48 hours ago. A two-hour conversation that at last check had already racked up over 1 million views on YouTube And with good reason. Not every day did a disgraced, ousted CEO who sweats garlic butter sits down and tells their side of the story in great detail for great length, especially while still in the midst of legal action. Except PJ, he doesn't give a damn. He already lost a $1 billion company. What else is left? The interview started with it logically, where it should start, right? Interviewer says, what do we call you? Papa? Papa John. John. Pizza inhaler. Garlic butter lover. Like, what do we call you, man?
Do I call you Papa? What do people call you?
Papa.
What about your friends and family? Do they call you Papa?
Yes.
Everyone really? Calls you Papa.
Yes.
Awkward. In other words, he loves it when you call him Papa. Even though everybody was calling this guy by a self-gloss of Papa, there was one person who was not. One person would not give him what he wanted and call him Papa.
I know you're recently divorced. You were married for a long time. Was she calling you Papa?
No, she never called me Papa.
She called you John.
Yeah, she called me John.
Okay, she never called you Papa.
Shout out to the interviewer, Ethan Klein, for getting PJ to admit that the ex-Heat did not call him Papa. Got that on tape. Way to get that on tape. Shout out again to Ethan Klein for going to an extremely awkward place with it seconds later.
Are you dating?
Slowly but surely.
Papa's getting out there.
No, I wouldn't
getting
say that.
Some weird out there, Papa?
I wouldn't say that either.
I wonder if there's any, like, if girls might be into, like, role-playing with you where they, like, that you play the Papa or some you know how they say, like, call me Daddy? Call me Papa?
Would you want someone that is, let's say, in the pizza category?
I don't know if you really can pick. You know, I think if you just go out and look for certain attributes, you know, I don't think that'll work. I think it'll just have to happen.
Gotta respect that. Hey, would you want somebody in the pizza category? That's one of the best questions ever. Like, are you partial to blondes, brunettes? Oh, me. No, I'm partial to somebody in the pizza category, man. That's always a huge turn on. Let's get to the real reason, though, the interview's making so many headlines. It's because Papa John addressed his claim that he hammered 40 of their pies in 30 days.
You did an interview, let's start here, in November, in which you famously claimed you have eaten over 40 pizza in 30 days.
Well, I didn't say I'd eaten 40 pizzas in 30 days. I said I had 40 pizzas in 30 days.
Well, hold on. We're going to split hairs here.
Well, when I said had a pizza, means I'm inspecting.
Right.
You know, and so I'm not eating every pizza. I may be eating parts of pizzas. But
how many pizzas do you eat on a weekly basis?
I probably eat 8 or 9 slices a week. Probably when I was at Papa John's, I was probably 12 or 15 because we're always testing new product. You know, pizza is actually very nutritious, very healthy. You just can't eat a bunch of it. I mean, it's
you sounds would
like,
agree.
That sounds like pizza propaganda.
It sounds like a lie. That's what it sounds like. 40 seconds of pure lies. Dude just copped a lying to the American public about going all Kobayashi on 40 pies in 30 days, and played out some bizarre semantics card about the difference between having pizza and eating pizza, and then proceeded to call pizza very nutritious and very healthy. Are you going to lie about that later on, or is that what I heard?
Well, I didn't say I'd eaten 40 pizzas in 30 days. I said I had 40 pizzas in 30 days.
Well, hold on. We're going to split hairs here.
I didn't say that I've eaten 40 pizzas in 30 days. I said I had 40 pizzas in 30 days. This dude talking out of both sides of his pizza-inhaling mouth. Look, 40 pizzas in 30 days is roughly 1 1/3 pizzas a day, entire pizzas a day. That's the stuff of legend. But now you're going to backpedal. Backpedal and say that you were inspecting pizzas and only eating 8 or 9 slices per week. Come on, Pops. Big, big difference. Inhaling 1.3 entire pizzas a week is a hell of a lot less remarkable than 1.3 a day. I mean, so did you lie to the American public? Or did you misspeak back in November? Or did you go all Roger Clemens with it and just misremember? Bookmark that for a second. There's a lot more where that came from. And they got around to talking about that racial slur, too, that cost him his job. And he's talking that on both sides of his pizza-inhaling mouth on that one as well. Oh, and at last check, Mark Shapiro, still not in jail. Nor is he going to jail. You believe this guy walked that back? Yeah, no, I didn't have 40 pizzas. I didn't eat 40 pizzas. I had 40 pizzas. Oh, why didn't you say so? Man, stop lying. He is Will Brinson. What's up, Will?
Jim, what's going on, man? I appreciate the upgrade on my title there. Nothing says niche content like Rally Beard Sports Expert.
My man, you are all of that, and you are getting bigger and better every single day. Now, Will, you are a legendary Phil Rivers fan. How you feeling right now that he is no longer a member of the Chargers? Has that sunk in for you?
Oh, no, sorry. I was just glad I broke up with the Chargers. You got to be the dumper. You don't want to be the dumpy in these situations. And I, you know, we sort of saw this coming, right? I mean, Rivers moved his family to Florida. He didn't do that. Didn't do that to make the commute longer. You know, he didn't want to deal with. He was already dealing with San Diego to L.A. He didn't need Florida to L.A. And it just seemed like the Chargers had sort of decided to move on. The crazy thing to me is that Anthony Lynn. They basically picked Anthony Lynn, who won 5 games last year and then got a contract extension. No big deal. They picked him over Philip Rivers, who's one of the 3 greatest players in franchise history, which, sure, go for it. What I don't understand is why they think they're just going to go to Tyrod Taylor and it's going to fix everything. What about this offensive line that's been problematic? What about the injuries that have been problematic for you know, a decade now with the Chargers? Maybe not a coincidence there that they can't stay healthy. And so, to me, look, I get what the Chargers are doing. They probably need to reboot at some point. Maybe they decide to trade for Cam Newton. Maybe they try to sign Tom Brady. Maybe they draft, somebody. I mean, maybe they pick up somebody in the first round. Maybe Tua falls to him. Who knows? Justin Herbert. To me, it feels like they handled this poorly, and they're sort of trying to circle back and to try and make things right by Rivers with this whole montage thing.
We were talking to Will Brinson. All right, so there's a lot to unpack there. Now, Will, the thinking had been that Tom Brady would be very interested in joining the Chargers, but to your point, when you look at the Chargers' pass protection being near the bottom the last 2 seasons and below league average for more than a decade, I'll get back to Brady in 1 minute. What does that tell you, though, about Philip Rivers?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it says that you have a team in the Chargers that, like, I don't know. I mean, like, I think you watch Philip Rivers play, and I'm biased, right? I mean, I got a little bit of bias built here. But I think when you watch Philip Rivers play, you see somebody who didn't fall off as much as people want to think. I mean, Pro Football Focus grades this offensive line as last or next to last over the last 2 years. And I think there are a couple of spots for Philip Rivers when you look at where he could go in free agency that make a lot of sense and were really tailored to his skill set. First of all, Tampa Bay, I think he'd be a good fit with Bruce Arians. We saw what Arians did with Carson Palmer. He's able to revitalize his career. You know, you have that hang in the pocket, stay tough, in the face of pressure, throw the ball down the field. You got great weapons of Mike Evans, Chris Godwin. You know, they don't have the run game that you might like to have, but maybe they go out and trade for David Johnson. Who knows and what will happen with that situation. But then Indianapolis, to me, is even better. Frank Reich, Phil Rivers, quarterback's coach from San Diego, he loves Rivers. They have a great offensive line, a strong run game, good weapons, and a pretty good defense. I think Phil in that dome where Peyton Manning played could really thrive for Indianapolis, and I would be surprised if he doesn't have a big market out there.
I think that makes perfect sense for him. Will Brinson joining us. All right, so back to Tom Brady. If you're Tom Brady and you know what you know about the offensive line for the Chargers and what you and I are talking about right now, how big of a red flag would that be for Brady when it comes to the Chargers?
Here's what I don't get, Jim. If Tom, like, we know about Tom Brady is that he wants to win, right? Is he trying to make this move to win football games and to win a Super Bowl without Bill Belichick, this hypothetical move? Because if he's doing that, to me, it doesn't make sense to go to L.A. One, that offensive line has been a problem. Two, we've seen the receivers. They have a ton of talent there, but Hunter Henry's a free agent. Keenan Allen and Mike Williams haven't exactly been the healthiest guys in the NFL over the last few years. And then three, why would you go to Patrick Mahomes' division? Who would go to Patrick Mahomes in Andy Reid's division if you want to win a Super Bowl? You're leaving the AFC East to face Patrick Mahomes twice a year? That's lunacy. If Brady wants to go to L.A. and build his brand, more power to him, and I salute him for building a TB12 facility out there in L.A. I encourage everybody to avoid tomatoes and try avocados and to do all the things that Tom Brady preaches. It'll probably make you healthier. But if this guy's about winning, then in my mind, it would be lunacy to go out to L.A. I think somewhere like Nashville makes more sense, and I think New England makes a lot more sense, too.
Preach. You know what I hate? I absolutely hate the inflammatory qualities of tomatoes. Man, I hate that so much. Yeah, sure I don't, Will. If I eat a tomato, I'm a legend. You imagine a guy saying, oh, no, I don't eat tomatoes. I don't eat tomatoes, man. They're not healthy. What, tomatoes aren't healthy? If I eat one tomato, I'm a legend.
Dude, I mean, Matt, like, you're cutting out – he's cutting out, like, high-quality fruits and vegetables from his diet because that's how good his diet is. Like, I'm just trying to cut out, like, beer and cheeses. Tom Brady's out here cutting out tomatoes.
I know, seriously, if I said no to bread before dinner, I'm like, man, I'm a legend. The discipline is just unbelievable. All right, Will Brinson, my guest. What about Drew Brees? Now, if Drew Brees, let me just jump ahead to that. If he were to retire, is it a foregone conclusion that the Saints would go to Taysom Hill? What would happen if he did retire?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talked about this on the Pick Six podcast episodes coming up on Thursday and Friday. We had to pre-record them because I'm going out of Great Wolf Lodge to do some water slides with my son for his belated birthday. So, but with Breeze, two things about this. One, I don't get this Taysom Hill stuff. I understand that he's a great gadget player and he's been an important piece for the Saints in terms of what they've done over the last few years. And I think that Sean Payton can be as creative as he wants and really come up with some interesting things for Taysom Hill. This guy has 13 career passing attempts, Jim. How is he going to fill Drew Brees' shoes in New Orleans if Brees retires? I think what Peyton's doing is he's puffing up the Taysom Hill's value. He'd love to trade him or let somebody try and come in with a restricted free agent offer and let them, you know, not worry about matching it. And then if Brees retires, what Sean Payton can do is go and say, hey, you know, you're talking about Indianapolis, you're talking about L.A., you're talking about Nashville. No, no, no. I have the best open job. New Orleans with me, Sean Payton, the offensive genius. Mike Thomas, Alvin Kamara, a great offensive line. A dome that you can play in. Hey, Tom Brady, Phillip Rivers, Jameis Winston, why don't you come down here and let's win a title? I think that's the spot that no one's talking about if Drew Brees retires. All of a sudden, New Orleans will become the best location for all the free agent quarterbacks.
Will Brinson joining us. What about that, though? What if you don't get one of those guys, Will? What if it comes down to Taysom Hill and Teddy Bridgewater? If that's your choice and that's the offense you have, what they have right now, who would you rather have as your quarterback, Bridgewater or Hill?
I'd rather go with Teddy Bridgewater, which is exactly what Sean Payton did when Drew Brees got hurt last year. That's the thing that I can't get past is if Taysom Hill is the future quarterback for the Saints, why didn't they put him in last year? I understand you have to rebuild your offense and change what you want to do, but you have a guy like Alvin Kamara. You have a guy like Mike Thomas. And like Ken Gard Mike is one of the best wide receivers in football. You're going to minimize the number of times he's touching the ball because you want to build a Lamar Jackson-like offense around Taysom Hill? It just doesn't pass the walk into the look, go look in the mirror and say it out loud test. Like, it just doesn't pass it. And so I think they would go Teddy Bridgewater, even though the rumblings you hear that Teddy's going to try and go out there and hit the market again.
Will Brinson, my guest. Will, one last thought before you go. Kind of a big picture item. The 49ers, of course, came within minutes of winning the Super Bowl, and then they came up short. Now, Will, if you look back, the Seahawks losing to the Patriots the way that they did seemed to devastate that team. The Falcons have never been the same since their Super Bowl loss. Obviously, there are other factors in play, but could you see the loss to the Chiefs that the 49ers suffered when they were that close to winning, lingering for them the way it has for other teams, or are they built differently?
Well, I think it's somewhere in between, Jim. To me, it's a team that is coached well enough with Kyle Shanahan. You know, they didn't lose any coaches in this hiring process. Robert Saleh is sticking around. They have a lot of talent on the defensive line. That pass rush is a lot of, you know, that sort of pass rush is easier to generate year over year. Versus, you know, having a great run defense, et cetera. So I don't think they'll see a huge drop-off in that regard. I think Shanahan's schemes offensively will keep them going. But to to me, it's a little bit like last year with the Rams, where, you know, they just felt like, oh, man, like a gut punch when you get to the Super Bowl. You're overwhelmed by Bill Belichick. Your offense sort of clogs up. And I wouldn't be surprised if the 49ers took a step back next year and were somewhere in the 8, 9, 10 win range, right there in the mix in the division. We know Seattle's going to have Russell. The Rams are trying to sort of retool on the fly. They don't have a ton of draft picks, but they have talent. And then Arizona looks like a team on the rise to me. So I think the division is tougher. I think there's a lot of tough teams in the NFC. And so I could absolutely see them taking a step back, although I think the infrastructure that Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch have built there is something that can last over the next 3, 4, 5 years.
He is a CBS Sports senior writer, host of the Pick Six NFL podcast, good friend of the program, and again, very importantly, the preeminent sports beer analyst and reporter in Raleigh. Will, it's good to have you back. I appreciate you. Great having you on.
Always fun, Jim.
Feels like half the starting quarterbacks in the NFL might be playing someplace else next year. And the ones that are not in the process of negotiating new contracts, if they're not going to be wearing a new jersey, they'll be rolling in a new car because they're getting new money. As an example, what does Tampa Bay do with Jameis Winston? Do they run it back with Jameis Winston? He's coming off one of the all-time legendary NFL seasons. 33 touchdowns, 30 picks. That is the greatest 30-30 club of all time. Like my man, Jose Canseco. Scoreboard, look up at it. That 30-30 is even more impressive than Jose's 40-40. And Jose's 40-40, to me, prior to this, was like the best thing ever. I mean, I don't care how roided out of his mind he was when he did it, if he was 40-40. When hitting 40 home runs was still a thing. When ripping 40 bags was still a thing. If you did either one of those things at that time, you were a legend. And he did both. So to me, that was one of my favorite things I'd ever seen until I saw Jameis Winston go 30-30. 30-30 is so much better than Canseco's 40-40, especially when you consider that Jameis also threw for 5,100 yards. And opponents scored 112 points off his turnovers. That's incredible. Numbers don't always tell you everything, but those numbers tell you that Jameis just had the most amazing single season a quarterback has ever had. I'm tempted to say Jameis just had the most amazing season that any athlete in any sport has ever had.
How many of you want to eat a W tonight?
33 TDs and 30 picks and over 5,000 yards passing. And that's just one team and one quarterback. I could go division by division in the NFL because there are that many decisions that have to be made regarding quarterbacks. And yet somehow, one of the biggest decisions involving the biggest team still has not been made. And I'm talking about Dak Prescott and his contract. Remember back in August, Jerry Jones gave everybody an update on the contract discussions and negotiations with Dak, Zeke, and Amari. And remember, this old man take is graphic in nature. If you're at all squeamish, or if you have any kids in the car listening with you right now, you might want to sit the next 20 seconds or so out. Again, this old man take is graphic in nature.
Picture if you were a driver of a car and you had a wreck and your hand was almost severed off, but you didn't understand your anatomy. You look down, you're spurting blood, you open the door and run to the woods and either die bleeding to death or shock. The educated man looks down, knows his anatomy, squeezes and knows his best chance is to wait for help. That's because he's been there a lot and done that. And so I'm waiting, I'm squeezing and waiting for help.
6 months later, that old man is still squeezing because Dak still does not have a contract. But according to Ian Rappaport, they're trying to get something done. Maybe. Possibly. Who the hell knows? He tweeted, quote, "The Cowboys are going to try to buck history, attempting to get a deal done with QB Dak Prescott by the close of the franchise tag window on March 10th. A lot will have to happen for a deal to come together," end quote. See, the thing is, that's not really a deadline. because there are no consequences for not getting a deal done at that point. But sure, go ahead and try to get a deal done by that point and say there's a deadline. I mean, you've only been talking about it now for like a year, right? Maybe a fake deadline will help you out. Or maybe those bizarre suggestions that the Cowboys might be interested in an aging Tom Brady might help you out. Yeah, sure they're interested in him, because that makes so much sense, even for wacky Jera. Now, the question, as always, is money, because people were freaking out when Prescott reportedly turned down $30 million a year. But, and we've covered this, but since people are still freaking out, I have to cover it again. When you consider what Carson Wentz got and how much more reliable Prescott has been than Carson Wentz, it would be idiotic for Prescott to take anything less than Carson Wentz. There are only a couple of topics in all of sports more polarizing than what Dak Prescott is worth, because a hell of a lot of people think that he's worth a hell of a lot less than what he's about to get. Do I need to repeat that? A hell of a lot of people think that he's worth a hell of a lot less than what he is actually about to get. Let me make this very simple for you yet again. Dak Prescott's worth whatever he can squeeze the Cowboys for. It's that simple. As always, when it comes down to quarterbacks' contracts, it is about timing, and it's about being in the right place at the right time to set the new bar. The current bar is Russell Wilson at $35 million. And no, that is not a green light for you to go off on the man's lettuce and his hair. Again, we're talking contracts. The current bar is Russ at 35. Patrick Mahomes and Dak are on deck. And now the question is not about 30 or 35. It's about more. It's about having a 40 in front of it. So Dak sat down with Kimberly Martin. She asked him the $40 million question.
Are you a $40 million quarterback?
You tell me.
I'm asking you. You're the one that, it's your
You're
contract.
You're the prognosticator.
I'm not the one writing the checks, though.
Yeah, I'm not either. If it's my call to write it, yeah, no telling. I mean, let's be honest, right? So, I mean, like I said before, though, I mean, I trust my agent. I trust the Cowboys. Something will get done. We're not going to sit here and put a number on it. Something will happen.
Let me translate that for you. Hell yes, I'm a $40 million quarterback. You know I'm a $40 million quarterback. Or perhaps a more accurate translation. I'm sure as hell not going to sit here and say that I'm not a $40 million quarterback. And by the way, nor should he. Why would he say that? Even if you don't like Dak, even if you don't respect Dak's game, would you respect Dak if he were to sit there and say, hey, yeah, you know, no. Do I look like a $40 million quarterback? Oh, come on, man. No, I'm not worth that kind of money. Would you respect him if he said that? I know I wouldn't. You want a guy who believes that he's worth every penny and is going to go out there and prove it. But I know people are going to hear that and freak out and talk about Dak's numbers and how he's not worth it and talk about how he's demanding a $40 million deal, which is not what he's doing. But save your breath. That argument is not worth it. You'd think the Cowboys, though, would be in a hurry to get this deal done before Mahomes raises the bar yet again. You would think they'd want to get this resolved so that Dak and Jera's new best friend, Mike McCarthy, can get to work with no distractions. Wouldn't you think that? You'd think that, but it sure seems like Dallas is not in any hurry at all. And obviously, Dak isn't either. Why would Dak be? He's been betting on himself this entire time. He's perfectly willing to let the bar go up and let his price tag go up. So while Jera is standing off there to the side, bleeding out and squeezing his extremities, waiting for help after a car accident in the woods, Dak's just going to be patient and wait for the bar to go even higher. Maybe that's not what Jerry's doing. Maybe Jera just has not completed that circumcision on that mosquito yet.
Circumcising the mosquito.
And your hand was almost severed off.
Tom Izzo is my guest. Tom, it's good to have you back in the jungle. How are you?
Well, thanks for having me back, Jim. I enjoy it.
Me too, Tom. It's always good to talk to you, and we have a lot to get caught up on. Let me just jump right into it. You're coming off that win over Illinois, 70-69. They were ranked 22nd. You got them at their place. Xavier Tillman, Tom, had the go-ahead dunk with just over 6 seconds left. Before we get into the final sequence, let me just say you were coming off a stretch, tough stretch, and you knew you were facing a really tough Illinois team. So what was your message to your squad before the game?
Well, Jim, you and I have known each other for quite a while. You've known my teams, and you know, we've gone through a lot this year with some injuries and the unfortunate situation that Cassius went through with his brother. But we just seem to be the three games we played, we were missing layups. We weren't playing as hard. Sometimes, as I say all the time, if the head dies, the body follows, or if the head's hurt and the body follows, and it's been a little bit of a stretch, but we just decided to get back to, working on playing a little harder and a little smarter. And in all honesty, Cassius was in foul trouble and played good when he was in there. But we had other guys that stepped up. Rocket Watts, a freshman I got from Detroit, was really good. And Xavier was really, really good. And yet Cassius made some big plays in the last 4 minutes, and that's what great players do.
Tom Izzo joining us. All of that is true. And you had that big lead early on, 37-20, and then Illinois, because they're good and they're tough, they made their run. You know, it would have been a lot easier for you guys to give up on that game when Illinois went on that run in the second half, but they did not do that. And then with 17 seconds left, you're down by one. The story goes that you drew up a play with a couple of different options, but to set it up even more, Xavier Tillman has had some layups and close looks, Tom, over the course of the year that he missed that I know that he would love to have back. What have you made with how he's responded to those moments?
Jim, he'd be one of your favorite guys. You know, he's tough. He's smart. I think he's got a chance to be an academic All-American. He's got a lot of great things going for him. You know, he's a dad. He's married. It's just a different bird. But he's such a good kid, and he has missed more than a couple layups in a couple of really tight games, in Wisconsin especially, Indiana. And this was big. So we did have a play drawn up, and yet, like Judd used to say about Magic, you know, draw the play up, and then at the end you say, Magic, do what you want. Well, when you got a guy like Cassius, I kind of did the same thing. And if it doesn't work, you're going to have to penetrate. He did. He got it up on the rim. And thank God for Xavier. He came, and instead of laying it up, he dunked it down. And I think that was even a higher percentage shot.
Involved. In fact, I know it did because he got that post-game water bottle shower when he got back to the locker room. Tom Izzo, my guest. You know, Tom, he had 17 points, 11 boards, 3 assists, a couple of steals, and a block last night. He's averaging a double-double this season. But how much of what he brings to your team is about his leadership and the fact that he'll call teammates out when he has to, like when he got on Gabe Brown for not boxing out during the Michigan game?
Boy, I tell you what, it's what I love about you. You get in depth in everything you do, and to know that is pretty good because that was, you know, not the norm all the time. He's kind of a quiet leader in some ways, but he kind of knows when to bark and when not to bark, and I think he has the respect of the players, and he did jump on Gabe. Man, we played that back and back. We were proud of him, but, you know, Xavier's the type of kid that he's reliable as the day is long. You know, he's going to be a good defender. He can score in the post. He hit a three. Pretty versatile kid. He's my poor man's version of Draymond Green, my poor man's version. A little bigger, not quite as good with the ball in that, but he's got some of those same qualities and toughness.
Talking to Tom Izzo, I appreciate your thoughts too, Tom, about what you said in terms of the way we approach this. You know, I respect that, and I respect anybody who comes on the program. I'm always going to make sure that I'm prepared to talk to anybody, but especially you, as you point out, you and I go back so far. You know, it wasn't just Tillman last night. Cassius Winston, as you mentioned, had fought through some foul trouble. He gave you 12 points. He gave you 3 steals. When you and I spoke earlier in the season, we talked about Cassius and the person he is and the emotional burden that he's had to carry this year. You've been around him a really long time, and you know how special he is, but what have you learned about him as he's continued to go through this experience?
Well, it's been, you know, I just left him for an hour and a half just in my office here an hour ago, and he has his moments. It's unfortunate. It was 3 months, 2 days ago since it happened, and as many of the people, including Tony Dungy, who's been through it, have told us that, you know, it's going to be like waves. It's going to come and go, and there's going to be different parts. It'll never go away, and it'll never be the same, but you got to learn to deal with it. And I think what it's done is it's, you know, physically he's really gotten a lot stronger and better. He came back his senior year to do that. But, boy, when you have mental fatigue, and I think there's been more of that, you know, not sleeping and some setbacks where maybe just seemed like he wasn't there. You know, we've dealt with some of that, but every day he's making some progress, and the more he talks about it, I think the more progress he's making. But, you know, he's already a grad student. He's going to have his master's when he leaves. Hard to coach guys smarter than the coach, Jim, but I'm trying to do it.
Tom Izzo, my guest. That's a good point. Tom, what about mental fatigue? You mentioned, like, when the head dies, the body goes, or when the head's not right, the body goes. And mental fatigue, is it just a matter of rest and recovery? How do you address mental fatigue? How do you get around that? How do you work through that? What do you coach your players to do with that?
Well, I'll tell you what I did with Cash just this morning, because it just happened. I just said, we got to talk about it more. You know, I think when you go through something like this, especially a suicide, you know, you don't want to talk about it, and then it becomes a burden on you, and you lay in bed at night, and you look up at the ceiling, and, you know, I just said, you got to trust me and talk to me more, and, you know, we get him some professional help and everything, because it's just one of those grieving moments that everybody handles differently. But, you know, the old deal about being there when he needs me, but still find a way to push him. And I got to admit, it's been hard. My style isn't quite that way, you know. But sometimes I've got to be a little more understanding and laid back. And once in a while, he'll say to me, Coach, you better get on me. And so I think we're getting closer and closer to understanding each other. But until you go through something like that, and I haven't, other than through him, I don't know if you never know what it's really like. And I'm just proud of what he's done dealing with this and still playing at a pretty high level.
It's cliche, but there is no playbook for something like that. Tom Izzo is joining us.
No.
You know, I mentioned you've got number 9 Maryland coming to town this weekend. I want to ask you about the festivities around that game before the game itself. You are hosting College Game Day. You're celebrating the 2000 National Championship team. How special is it when that group gets together?
Well, it's going to be special, you know, Mateen and all the guys, and they're all coming back. We got one coming from Australia. We got one coming from France. So we've got, I think, just about everybody will be back. And then we have an alumni weekend the same time. So there'll be a couple hundred of former players and managers and, you know, a lot of things going on, Jim. And, you know, what I got to do is try to focus on the game until after the game and then enjoy the guys. But it's a big weekend, game day here and all the things, you know. And, I mean, I'm proud that we're in a position, because we haven't played very well. I mean, you know, 3 games. Now, we lost 3 close games, but, you know, most of it, I give the credit to those teams that played us. They played well, but we didn't play well, and I think we've got to home up to that when that happens, too, and we have. We're trying to work around it. We're trying to practice a little harder, see if we can get this train rolling again.
All right, so what about Maryland? They're coming in. You know, when you look at them and you look at the challenge, how do you go about getting your team ready to face this particular Maryland squad?
Well, Maryland's got two, what I would call, you know, great, great players. Anthony Collins is really, you know, a good player. And then you've got Jalen Smith, you know, at 6'10". This year he's shooting the ball from all over. I mean, he's definitely going to be not a pro prospect, he's going to be a pro. So they've got an inside, they've got an outside. They're not as big as some of the teams. I mean, other than Smith, they got a lot of 6'4 to 6'6 guys, and they're athletic. They spread the court a little bit like Illinois, maybe shoot it a little better, but you know, it's going to be a challenge for us, and maybe we'll change up our lineup a little bit or what we do. But should be a raucous day in Breslin, and one that I'm really looking forward to, and see what happens.
Before I let you go, Tom, I'm flashing back. Since it's an alumni weekend, I'm thinking about some of the great players that have come through there, and I'm thinking about my time back in the day when was before you and I even spoke, I was at UC Santa Barbara and Jerry Pym was the coach and the Gauchos made the tournament. Yeah. And for a small program like us, that was a big, big deal. That was exciting. And I think we were in Knoxville for the regional and and we were winning now. And Steve Smith just shot lights out in the second half and just tore my heart. Like, he reached into my chest and he ripped my heart out. And for years we'd laugh about that. I'm like, do you even remember that game? Do you remember us?
You know, we beat you guys, and I think we played Popeye Jones and that group, and we beat them and by one in overtime. We would have been the first one seed to lose to a 16 back then, so that was a heck of a weekend. But Jerry Pym was, he was a good friend of Judd Heathcote's, and, you know, that was a pretty exciting time for you guys, too. And Smitty should be here this week, and he's one of the not only great guys, he's been a big donor, and he's been a great friend. Jim, he was the first player I recruited to Michigan State when I became a full-time assistant.
How big was that for you at that time?
Probably got me the job. I kiss him every time I see him.
No doubt. I can see what a recruit like that would do for you. And if you're going to have your hands full, Tom, all weekend, but if you have a moment with him, maybe you say to him, man, Rome is still crying about that three ball you knocked in, how you knocked his Gauchos out of the tournament. Good times, though.
I can say Rome is crying, not burning, then. That's what I'm going to tell him.
There you go, touche. Well played, Tom Izzo. He's the head basketball coach of Michigan State. I ran down that resume. They're 17-8. They're third place in the conference, and they've got a big one coming up on Saturday night where they're hosting number 9, Maryland. Great to have you back, Tom. Have an amazing weekend, and it's always good to have you on the show and get caught up with you.
Hey, Jimmy, thanks a lot for having me in the jungle. I appreciate it. Appreciate what you do.
You too.
Good night now!